like to call it. But in this tradition, in other traditions, we see that people, or us as human beings, will already either benefit in that particular realm or begin our punishment in that particular realm, depending on us and our actions and our deeds. So in this tradition from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, the Imam says that the souls of the believers will be in chambers in paradise. Now, this paradise is talking about is not the paradise that is on the Day of Judgment. How do we know this? Because of the following statements in the tradition. The Imam says that the souls of the believers will be in chambers in paradise, eating of its food and drinking its drinks and visiting one another. So the believers will know who one another are, because the souls of the believers, even though they were not physically aware of one another, they were attached to a higher reality, and it is there that they became acquainted with one another. Saying, so these believers will be saying, "Our Lord, bring the final hour so that you may fulfill what you promised us." So therefore we see that paradise is not the paradise of the final hour. That is something else. This is the middle ground. So we see that even that middle, or that purgatory, or that barzakh, will have what is known as a paradise, in inverted commas, if you like to say, and in other traditions, a hell, in inverted commas, as well. So people will be benefiting from that particular realm, or being punished. Inshallah, until next time, my dear brothers and sisters. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Pegasus, an Israeli spyware, the malware for mobile phones, has been spying on anyone from regular citizens to heads of states and journalists. The audio and video of one's phone can be turned on without the owner knowing it. And everything can be accessed, from old messages to notes on your phone, contacts. Nothing is safe. How dangerous is this? And what can be done to stop it? We will be taking a look at all of this on the Spotlight.
More victims of a malicious Pegasus software hacking scandal have been revealed, as phone numbers of several prominent British Muslim activists have appeared in a leaked list of successful hacks by the Israeli-made spyware. The list includes Raghad al-Tikriti of the Muslim Association of Britain, Mohammed Kosbar of Finsbury Park Mosque, Baroness Paula O'Dean, and Anas al-Tikriti of the Cordoba Foundation. Mr. al-Tikriti suspects he was hacked by agents from the Emirates over his past criticism of the regime.
I've had a long-standing struggle with the UAE, and simply because over 10 years ago, I highlighted the fact that the UAE had persecuted and followed on by a prosecution of dozens of reformists, of people who called for democracy, who called for accountability, who called for transparency in their own country. It's a scandal. It's a complete scandal, just like all the scandals that engulf us, unfortunately, on every single level. Infringing on someone's entire life. I mean, this Pegasus software, apparently, I'm no technician, but I understand that I'm being told by experts that it basically takes control of your mobile phone, which essentially is, and this is, you know, something that humanity needs to contend with, is our entire lives.
At least 400 British citizens have been targeted by foreign regimes using Pegasus, yet number 10 has remained stunningly silent on the matter.
How on earth could Great Britain, no less, be blasé regarding 400 of its citizens being attacked in such a callous, obscene, despicable manner by a regime that is non-democratic, absolutely, it's anti-democratic, authoritarian, rogue, corrupt regime such as the United Arab Emirates.
The UAE have failed to respond to the accusations, but they are ultimately just one of up to 40 regimes currently using the Pegasus service. The real question for British victims is, did local intelligence services know about the hacking? And if not, how could this failure have possibly been allowed to occur? Robert Carter, London.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the programme, author and researcher Daniel Gunja out of Barcelona, and journalist and commentator Ramiro Funes out of Los Angeles. Thank you both for being with us. Well, I'm going to start this off in Barcelona. And Daniel, we have heard for years that smartphones can listen in and even see its owners without them knowing. Tell me what is different about this Pegasus spyware and what makes it so much more dangerous.
Pegasus spyware is able to be installed on the phone without the owner doing anything. It can be installed remotely without the owner having any idea that it actually is on their phone. It can access their messages, can access their camera, their microphone, and is basically able to have full control over all the content on their phone, which makes it very dangerous. Now, the issue with Pegasus had also been raised previously. This is it is not new that what we know about the software. What is new now is, of course, the extent of how many people individually in higher positions have been targeted, which of course creates a completely new reality of a very global surveillance that is being. The record has its source in a Zionist entity where it has been, where this software has been developed with the backing of the Zionist regime directly.
Well, let me go over to Ramiro. Daniel just said something about the Zionist entity, and I want to pick up on that as far as this being an Israeli company and the danger of that in general, because we know that it is a regime that does not abide by any type of international law at all. Ramiro, your take on that side of it.
That's exactly right. I think the Pegasus software is extremely dangerous. It is part and parcel of the Zionist method of control using intelligence abroad. The founders of the quote-unquote State of Israel understood the importance of controlling key aspects of infrastructure and trade, controlling the key trade routes of society, hence why occupied Palestine, or the State of Israel, is where it is today, because it sits at the key intersections of infrastructure in the Middle East. Now, applying that same logic to the 21st century, what are the key infrastructure points? The internet, WhatsApp, Google, Facebook, these are the points of infrastructure that are used all over the world daily by every single person. I don't know a single person who doesn't have a smartphone, who doesn't have these apps. And so now we can consider these applications, these devices, as key infrastructure. And yet, once again, the Zionists have taken control of this key infrastructure, control the information that flows in and out, and see and monitor anybody who is in any way speaking out against their client governments. In Latin America, for example, one of the more lesser reported stories is that the Israeli government has been selling Pegasus, the Zionists have been selling Pegasus to the governments of Mexico, Honduras, and Colombia, three of which are key drug trading countries that are involved in the drug trade in the United States. And this software has been used to monitor, track, and assassinate activists, journalists who have spoken out against the crimes of the Mexican government, the Honduran government, the Colombian government, in collaboration with Mossad, with the IDF, with Israeli intelligence. So this is something that affects the entire world. It affects key infrastructure because everyone uses smartphone technology. And I think it's, again, part and parcel of the Zionist strategy of controlling the key points of infrastructure to make sure that nobody speaks out against their allies.
Daniel, your take on what Ramiro just said about as far as being selling this to certain governments. I want to look at the way that this malware can be used to control dissent, control whether we're talking about journalists, activists, and even sometimes heads of states, as we talked about earlier, that with this spyware, everything is accessible, which of course means very private information that could lead to blackmail.
Dangerous in so many ways, especially because it is not only a tool that was developed by the Zionists, was developed by people who have ties to the Zionist regime and was approved by it. It was also promoted by the Zionist regime to be sold to different regimes, but also it is being sold, it is disseminated and used in different ways. And even in, if I remember correctly, in 2018, there was an article in the Zionist newspaper that there was an investigative report on how many countries and how many regimes have been using this particular software to spy, but not only to spy on journalists, human rights activists, lawyers, academics, but also to coerce and threaten and blackmail people or to persecute minorities. So this can effectively, of course, lead to an increase of state violence and can have drastic implications for individuals and for population groups, which is what makes it dangerous on so many levels. But of course, it is part and parcel of the Zionist strategy, because as much of other technologies and mechanisms that the Zionist regime is selling globally, it has consolidated itself globally as a force for the creation of methods of population containment and control that had been practiced and tested on Palestinians for at least the last 73 years. So much of the surveillance is tested in Palestine, and in many ways, Pegasus is just one of the examples of the transnationalization of the violence against Palestinians, where Israel is using Palestinians and developing all sorts of methods that will help oppress people elsewhere and coerce people in key positions to coerce them into making decisions, which gives, again, the Zionist regime even much more power, potentially.
I mean, Romero, I mean, would you say that this cyber surveillance is a new weapon? Obviously, that is quite dangerous. And what needs to be done in order to control it, just as we have other weapons that there are various laws with it? What do you think about that? What can be done?
Cyber surveillance is definitely a weapon, not only because it serves to monitor your actions, to make sure that you stay in line, to make sure that you don't criticize Israel, to make sure that you don't criticize the U.S., the Western countries, but it also serves as a weapon, a mass weapon of distraction. Here in the United States, where I'm speaking to you now from, every day there are new applications, methods, devices, content designed to distract and miseducate the population, to keep people misinformed, to not care about what's going on around the world. And I think that this cyber surveillance, it plays a role as well when we're talking about predictive behavior and data. Based on the words that you type on your phone, based on the words that you say in conversations with people, the big tech companies, which are 100% in collaboration with the Zionist Entity of Israel, they use that data to predict your behavior and also to influence your behavior, to make it seem as if you want something that you really don't, to put content in your face and to want a desired outcome. And this is also used in the political sphere as well, where we see social media surveillance being used to promote regime change efforts in Cuba, to promote regime change efforts in the Middle East and all over the world. And so I think that cyber surveillance and spying and hacking is a huge threat, not only in terms of collecting data and keeping people in a low vibrational state of distraction, but also in terms of making you want something that you really didn't want. And I think in terms of correcting this, I think it really comes down to values. It really comes down to having progressive anti-imperialist governments realign the values of a society. I think Iran is doing a great job at that. I think countries like Nicaragua, Venezuela are doing a great job of that as well, where they're creating their own independent media companies, their own smartphone technology, their own devices that are free from some of the filth that we see in the Western societies, free from the hacking. And so I think it's really up to the anti-imperialist countries like Iran, like Russia, like China, Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, to develop independent technologies and infrastructure so that they can't get to our technologies to begin with, to create things that aren't designed to distract us and keep us in a low state. Okay. And so I think that's it.
Well, what about that, Daniel? He just said about the, which I like, the weapons of mass distraction. And he talked about the anti-imperialist front. But as you know, the anti-imperialist front is continually under pressure, whether we're talking about economic sanctions or we're talking about in the media war, the soft war. And on the other hand, so when you're still using some of their platforms, as we saw with Press TV basically being shut down and taken off of .com, so where do we go with this? On the one hand, the pressure is on economically. On the other hand, if we use their platforms or use their smartphones, now we see the situation with actually the Israeli regime being in control of most of it.
Rather a dilemma, and I agree that there need to be new ways to be found in order for anti-imperialist factions to develop different kinds of, maybe through a collaboration of alternative media. I mean, Press TV has this example you mentioned, when Press TV's domain was bought, Press TV managed very swiftly to use a different domain and still to continue its program without any major interruption, which showed that even those threats or direct forms of intimidation coming from the U.S. regime have been able to, Press TV was able to circumvent them. But of course, the danger is there. And effectively, there would need to be different ways to find alternative platforms that can be used. But also, I agree with what the other guest said, it's of course also a question of values, because as long as there is this imperialist structure, and as long as the Zionist entity exists, we will be faced with such challenges, because effectively even this cyber spying is just a digitalized form of different forms of spying that the Zionist entity has been employing for so many years, such as the conventional spying, where they would spy and conduct targeted assassinations against people. And these days, these things take place rather in online spaces. But there needs, of course, to be a continuous effort from within the resistance axis and from the resistance to counter these efforts, and of course, to remain aware of them.
Romero, why aren't we seeing more of a stronger reaction from Western governments? Because also some of them have been targeted. We saw that Emmanuel Macron of France, of course, was one of those that was targeted. And I mean, we have seen the reports coming out about Saudi Arabia and UAE, these authoritarian countries like this, using it to silence dissent. So these countries that at least try to say that they support human rights, some of these Western governments, why aren't we even hearing anything coming out of, for example, Washington or London in condemning this spyware?
I think Washington and London will never condemn any of the crimes of Israel and the Zionist entity, because it falls in line exactly with their foreign policy goals. When we're talking about the victims of these cyber attacks in the Middle East, we have, you know, targeting against Palestinians, against people in Yemen, against people in Afghanistan, Iran, and then in Latin America as well, you know, you have journalists, activists, academics in Mexico, Colombia, Honduras, countries that are neo-colonies of U.S. imperialism. All of that benefits the interests of Wall Street and the London Stock Exchange. And this is the new level and the new frontier of the war in the 21st century. We're no longer in the era of frontline soldiers and infantry combating each other. We're in a communicational war, a digital war of data, where if you have more data and information from your enemy, you can control them more. You can even predict their behavior. The technology with AI and algorithms, it's so advanced that you can manipulate a whole society into believing something that is not true. And so I think the reason why the Western countries will never call out Israel is because they're in fact collaborating with Israel to use this technology against their enemies, against their oppressors, and they're using this as a way to enter the next frontier of imperialism in the 21st century. And it's something that's very scary, and that's why I'm very proud of countries like Iran and Russia and China and others in the anti-imperialist bloc that are developing independent technology, because the second you agree to use their infrastructure, their technology, their apps, you're making yourself vulnerable to their exploitation, to them surveilling you if you speak out against them. And so it's so important for us to develop the next level of defense, a frontier, our own technologies, our own applications. And I think that's what it's going to take.
Daniel, what do you think about as for the possibility of a grassroots global movement in trying to get this type of spyware to be banned or to be deemed illegal? The possibility of that side of things?
As long as governments are continuing to use the spyware, I don't see much probability of that. Of course, now there is an awareness of the spyware, but still, like, even in the Western media, it hasn't been the Israeli role in it hasn't been as highlighted as much as it could have, and it has continued to be used by governments that, as you said, at least pretend that they are interested in human rights. While at the same time, of course, it also serves the Zionist regime to connect with its newfound allies. It has sold the software to the regimes in Saudi and Bahrain and UAE and so on, who don't even pretend that they care about human rights. So effectively, I do not think that could lead to the software being banned. And even if the Zionist regime has been promoting itself as a technological hub, as a very advanced digitalized entity, so I wouldn't be surprised if they have other softwares, if they're already developing other things that they can use to continue spying on. And as long as they have Palestine as a testing ground, as a laboratory, where they are abusing Palestinians to develop all sorts of technologies, I do not see that there is a potential end to that coming from even from grassroots, as long as it's in the Western imperialist framework.
Well, what about that, Ramiro? Daniel just talked about the Zionist regime and how it, even with the spyware, they're using it to try to promote themselves, like they are above the rest. We know they use, from a military perspective, they use a lot of propaganda to say that they're the strongest and the most moral. And now in dealing with technology, it's as if they want to say, we are superior, we are above the rest, and sort of an intimidation factor. What can be done about this? And what do you think about resistance media and the role of basically educating people to what's going on? Your take on what needs to be done on that side of things.
I think that's such a great point. One of the talking points of the Zionists is that Israel is a free, is paradise. You can do whatever you want. They boast about engaging in behavior, decadent behavior, in behavior that's immoral and behavior that is against traditional values. And Israel posits itself as a land of high-tech freedom, of unlimited access to whatever you want. And even within the internet realm, we also see the same thing happening with a lot of the adult content that a lot of Israeli companies have been supporting in the United States and the Western Hemisphere, that they're strongly connected to that. And it's something that is really hard for us in my generation, especially as a millennial, to really understand, because when they compare themselves to more traditional countries, Islamic countries that are preserving morals and values, that are not engaging in this online behavior, they make it seem as if they're better. And that's part of the chauvinism and the arrogance of Israel. They say that they're free, they're advanced, they're in the future, but they make a false equation of being advanced and high tech with being decadent, with being lewd, with being all sorts of kind of things. And I think it's important for a new culture to emerge online that is not based on lewd adult content, that is not based on some of the arrogance, on the decadence that we see on social media and on media platforms in general that highlight gross wealth and fame and luxury cars. We have to create a new culture and a new technology based around families, based around traditional living, based around anti-imperialism, preserving our way of life aside from the empire. And okay. I think that this is the only way out.
All right. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on this program. Author and researcher Daniel Jedrzejczyk out of Barcelona, and journalist and commentator Ramiro Funes out of Los Angeles. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, let there be light, and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint. A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program. And I'm Muhammad Jawad, the host of this program on IRIB English Radio, with my guest speakers, as always, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Hussein. Brother Hussein, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum salam. Glad to be here.
Well, Sayyid Abdullah, how about you? Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. We were talking about the movie Replicas, especially with the subject that we are trying to talk about. I'm talking about cloning. This movie, Replicas, budget was basically about $30 million.
Mm-hmm.
But the box office was a disaster. It was a bomb.
Yeah.
Around 9.3 million or 4 million, right?
So they lost more than what they made.
Exactly. How do you make of it? Especially we have the Keanu Reeves in it, you know? One of my favorite, really, actors.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, the thing is with Hollywood and actors, I think, especially in recent years, a lot of actors, they got desperate. Like, whatever you throw at them, they will take.
Mm-hmm.
Not that they actually... So back in the day, they would... like receive so many scripts and so many screens and screenwrites, and they reject, like, oh, no, I'm not going to play that role. So they very picky back in the day.
Yes.
Because they only make quality movies. Now these actors, as they get older, they become very, you know, these, like, whatever you throw them, they will take. So this movie, I'll guarantee you, not a lot of people heard of it. Even when it came to the box office, not a lot of people even heard of this such a movie. Keanu Reeves himself, he's that kind of character, where he himself is an introvert. Because I don't know if you've read about his life, he has a very dark life, the poor guy. He's been through hell and back many times. So even his personality on screen is always kind of that quiet, sad kind of guy, right? Mm-hmm. That things happen to him. The only roles that he seems to
Isn't it because of his, like, attraction toward the Eastern type of culture?
I'm not sure of that, but it's just, I think it's just because he has a lot of trauma. He's been traumatized from a young kid. Like, he's been traumatized by his parents, by his sister, by his wife, everyone that he has died. So his life is a very sad life. So he's been through a lot of traumas in his life. And then you can see it in his personality. The only times he succeeded was in The Matrix. And maybe a few other movies that he done a good role. In everything else, he didn't do very well. So he's not the kind of character that you would jump... And you're like, oh, he's Keanu Reeves, you know, let me go see his movie. Not that kind of character. So I think that contributed to the fact that, you know, he needs to come up with something so amazing for people to come and watch. So, for example, The Matrix and, you know, a few others, like, if you remember that movie, Constantine.
Yes, Constantine.
So some movies he done a really good job in.
Yes.
Because he took a different personality than his actual life story.
Yes.
So in this movie, he was playing himself. Being himself, right? So he lost his sister, he lost his mother, he lost his family, and he just, in the movie, he just lost them all. Yeah. And he's have that, you know.
It's very sad.
So it didn't work. It did very sad. Where, for example, when you watch John Wick, for example, it's an action movie.
Exactly.
And I think maybe that's the only style that suits him best, so he can, I don't know, he flourish in.
Yes.
With the rest, he didn't do very well. And that explains the box office, I guess.
I see.
It's a very typical movie. He didn't do anything out of the ordinary. Anyone could have done that job, you know. Any B-grade actor could have done his job.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that contributed to the fact that the box office didn't make it very well.
I see. Brother Hossein, you talked about the plot holes in the first episode that we talked about the replicas. Would you talk more about that, elaborate on it? Because it was raised basically by a lot of critics.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah, you know, like Brother Abdullah said, it was a very typical movie. So it's something that you would probably see like in a dream, something that you tell as a story, as like a good, like a bedtime story.
Yes.
Hey, you know, he went and he did this, and then this happened, and then this happened. There wasn't a very good, you know, there wasn't a good whole lot of transitions.
Yes.
And, you know, the bad production really played a role in that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it had that very, like, you know, present sense of awkwardness. Like,
yes.
Like, he just lost his family, and then he tells his guy to come in and bring the kit for the cloning and everything. Like, what? You just lost your family, bro. Like, you're supposed to be grieving. You're supposed to be, you know, like, devastated.
Yeah.
He didn't really show that. And, you know, it just goes to show that it wasn't very well-written script or it wasn't very good, a very well-produced film.
Yes. Okay, let me stop you there for a break. We'll be back and continue our discussion.
We got a donor inbound, 37 minutes.
Time since cardiac death?
7 hours, 15 minutes.
Proceed. Initiate sequence. We are going to replicate the human mind. We are going to take his biological brain, imprint it into that synthetic brain. Stand by to initiate neural imprint. All functions go.
Back to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Javad. Hosting this program, we are talking about replicas. Our guest speakers, as always, are still Brother Hossein and Sayyid Abdullah. Apart from the critical response that was generally unfavorable toward this movie replicas, like, for example, Rotten Tomatoes only holds an approval rating of 11% based on, of course, 56 reviews, and gave this movie 3.03% out of 10. Well, and we also see Metacritic's average score, which is 19 out of 100, which is very bad, disastrous, basically. And also we have Cinema Score, giving this film the average grade of C, basically on an A-plus to F scale. All right? Well, apart from this unfavorable or negative critical response, we see some moral issues raised, especially near the end of the movie, right? Like the deleting of the memories that happens on the part of Keanu Reeves, the major actor in this movie. How do you justify this? Would it be justifiable at all?
Well, if it is possible to delete someone's memory, obviously it's not moral or even allowed in God's books. Because even his friend, he said to him, "You're going to hell." He said to him, "You're going straight to hell."
Yes,
he said to him, "You're going straight to hell," which means like, I mean, you know, it's bad enough that you created a person from scratch, you know, but deleting the memory, taking something that is absolutely important in it. For example, if you could manipulate my mind and you could delete something extremely important, let's say, fundamentally important. For example, you can come to my mind and say, delete the fact that alcohol is haram, for example. And I'm like, okay, I go drink alcohol because my memory, I don't have anything in that regard, you know? Or take something very, so that could put me in a lot of trouble. But for the Persian who does it, obviously he's doing something wrong. And they raise that. And the guy was very precise about it. He's like, you're going straight to hell for this. So it's morally is not acceptable, and religiously, obviously, is not acceptable either. So it's a big no.
Yes.
So whether they can or can delete someone's memory, that's another question.
Yes. In one of our radio programs, which is called Back to Reality, I happen to be the host of that program, and I interviewed an expert in Islamic studies, Sister Zahra, about modern technologies such as cloning and its consequences. Let's hear what she has to say.
When it gets to nature and human nature, yeah, I think that's when it can become really dangerous. Also, there's other things.
But you cannot shy away from these.
Of course not.
New issues.
Of course not. This is technology, and we need to gain technology. We need to gain better insight into how humans are created. We're encouraged to do this by Islam. We are not told to stay away from technology.
Yeah.
But it makes me worry, what else will it be? Then it'll be eye color, then it'll be height, and maybe the rich who have more money will be able to choose the best height, the best eye color, for example, the best sex at that time. And what if, for example, all our celebrities go for instance, girls? Will that have an effect on the rest of the population all wanting girls looking exactly the same as Barbie, one particular celebrity? Or if one particular celebrity chooses a boy, I mean, there's so many, it gets into so many other areas. But I suppose we can put in laws to stop that. But I think there might be people who are inexperienced, maybe doctors who get hold of this technology and use it for the poorer people, the poorer people in the population. And I think that's when it could get really dangerous. There might be mutations in the way humans are created.
That was Sister Zahra from London, an expert in Islamic studies, talking about the consequences of modern technologies such as cloning. Brother Hussein, one of the other criticisms that this movie Replicas earned was based on the idea of genetic determination. This is exactly what Sayyid Abdullah was referring to. Like, when you delete the memory of a person, if you have the chance to, if you have this option, technologically speaking, and you get to choose, for example, which memories remain and which memories to go, all right? Then there would be no, let's say, fairness if you punish the person under question, all right? Because some of the memories, like what Sayyid Abdullah was saying, for example, alcohol is haram according to the laws, all right? And then you don't have that memories. And if you even go to alcohol, then there would be no punishment or reward at the end of the day, all right?
Yeah, so, you know, if it was possible, if you could delete memories, and, you know, usually that happens in this world, naturally, you know, if you get into a car crash, you hit your head really hard, you forget.
Or Alzheimer's.
Alzheimer's or the other.
But they are uncontrollable.
Yeah.
They're not natural.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. I mean, you know, naturally, I guess, I mean, by mistake or, you know.
Yeah.
But if you can deliberately delete a person's memories, of course, that would be unethical. And I feel like memories are very, very central to who a person is. It really controls who they're, like what their personality is like and how they act, how they make decisions.
Yes.
So of course, if you delete a memory from their from a person's mind, you can't punish them on it because they basically they didn't know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's take another break and we'll be back and continue our discussion.
Where am I?
Try to relax. You're coming online.
Who am I?
Who am I?
Something horrible goes wrong.
something already has.
Back to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. With me, Mohammad Javad, hosting this program, and my dear guests are still Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Hussein. We were talking about the movie Replicas, hovering around the issue of cloning. Brother Hussein, I asked you the question in the previous part about some of those criticism based on genetic determination, right? And you said that, in fact, some of that happened. I mean, like when we're talking about the end of the movie Replica, that some people get to choose, like to delete, for example, the memories of another person if you have this option available to you.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And there comes the idea of morality then. All right? But even in real life now, apart from cloning and all the technology-wise or related stuff, even some people, when they are affected by serious traumas, all right, they go to some therapists and they ask them to do something about them. And they want to get away or get rid of those memories that caused the trauma in the first place. So some of them refer even to hypnotists, those people who manage to or have the ability to hypnotize the subject and try to do something to their mind and their memories. Do you think even that hypnotism is moral?
See, there are some situations and some scenarios that I guess it would be more in the benefit, especially if the subject consents.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, if it's someone who is, for example, like dead or unconscious, you can't really decide that for them unless it's a very crucial memory. Like, for example, in the movie, Keanu Reeves, Dr. William, was working on something at night, and all of his family was sleeping, and his daughter,
yes,
she was sleeping, and he hears her scream out of fear, and he goes up and he realizes that she woke up because of a nightmare. And I feel like it was understood that this nightmare was actually the crash that mm-hmm. happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
And she was dreaming about that. So if he could have deleted the pain that they suffered before the crash, for example,
yes,
then yeah, of course that would, you know, it would spare her the emotional trauma that she'd have to go through, like she did in the movie. So in some situations, I guess it would be okay, especially if it's you know, critical or it's very you know, important.
Yes. Okay. Thank you very much, Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah. Thank you all for listening to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the movie Replicas, 2018 American science fiction thriller with Keanu Reeves as one of the major characters in it. Thank you for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Around the world with reporters.
Sheikh Ibrahim El-Zazaki and his wife.
Addressing the press, a member of Zazaki's defense team said the Kaduna State High Court discharged and acquitted Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat of all 8 charges in a ruling that lasted for several hours. The judge ruled that the prosecution has failed to establish any case against the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria and his wife.
The court ruled that the charge ought not to be in the first place. You cannot arraign a man for an offense that was allegedly committed, as at the time the said crime was not an offense. And the court was very emphatic in that yes, the Kaduna State government has powers to enact laws. They cannot enact laws to prosecute an offense retrospectively.
Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat were arrested in December 2015 following an attack on his home and worship center by soldiers of the Nigerian army, which resulted in the killing of hundreds of Zazaki's supporters. In a statement, the Islamic movement said the judgment is a vindication of Sheikh Zazaki and a victory for truth and justice against tyranny and oppression.
The events of December 12th and 15th of 2015 were orchestrated by state machineries who are using the instrumentalities of state apparatus to fight a religious fight. It is strictly the events of December 12th, 2015 is strictly a fight between Shiites and Sunnis, fights that was imported from Saudi Arabia for whatever purpose.
The Kaduna State High Court has set Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat free. The Islamic movement, and indeed many of Zazaki's supporters, have expressed happiness with the outcome of this judgment. Danjuma Abdullahi, Kaduna.
Three 3,000 of Ethiopian refugees crossed the Sudanese borders on Monday, arriving at Taya village at Basunda locality in Gadarifi state. Reports say the refugees is considered the biggest number of refugees to cross into the country in only one day since the outbreak of war last November in Tigray region. Many believe that the wave may worsen security and humanitarian situation in the region due to armed conflicts erupting at western area of Ethiopia.
Sudan has adopted an open-door policy in receiving Ethiopian refugees since the beginning of the conflict. So far, Sudan has welcomed about 75,000 to 80,000 refugees. We call on the international community to help us meet the needs of the increasing refugees fleeing from the fight in the Tigray region.
Since the beginning of fighting, tens of thousands of Ethiopians have sought safety in Sudan, but conditions in Sudan refugee camps are presenting new challenges, as Sudanese NGOs early responded to humanitarian situation in states affected of refugees influx.
Actually, since the crisis of the refugees started, the Tigray crisis started, Sudanese Red Crescent has been present from day one. And that is basically because we do have our ongoing activities in the region through our branches in Kassala and Gadarif. So we do have ongoing programs for for the already existed all refugees in the area. So with the beginning of the crisis, we were already on the ground.
In the light of the latest development in the Tigray region, UN agencies strive to maintain a strong staff presence, provided there is access in Hamadayet in case there is an increased influx. Several partners continue to remain on the ground in anticipation of this possibility.
Security and health challenges face Sudanese and Ethiopian governments to cope with increasing number of refugees. Khartoum says it is still waiting for international support to tackle the crisis. Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
An Algerian judoka athlete who made headlines last week for shunning an Israeli opponent at the Tokyo Olympics has now been temporarily suspended along with his coach from the International Judo Federation, meaning that Fethi Nurin will not be able to compete after making his bold statement in support of Palestine. After returning to Algeria, V secured an exclusive interview with Nurin to ask why he felt he had to walk.
I was pitted to play against an athlete from the usurper entity occupying Palestinian land, a regime which kills innocent people and drives them out of their homes, day and night. Because of this, I don't accept that my hand is smeared with someone who represents an entity like this, and for his flag to be associated with the Algerian flag, which is in support of the Palestinians' cause.
His actions meant he would miss out on a chance to win a medal, but Nurin admitted he had no regrets.
If the same situation arises, I would not hesitate to take the same decision. The world needs to know that Israel is an occupier and they practice all kinds of laws that deviate from the international laws and human rights. We need to send a message to the world that we deal with all religions with dignity, just as the Islamic religion recommended us to do. Except for the ones who fight against the religion and the Muslims. We are against them and it's our rights to respond to them. We have the right to defend our religion and all oppressed Muslims.
The Olympic Charter takes a strong stance against any political acts, stating that no kind of demonstration or political, religious or racial propaganda is permitted.
However, this isn't the first time that a Muslim athlete has protested against this controversial lineup. Many are now starting to ask questions about the Olympics and their lack of sensitivity on the subject. Also, are the games being used to whitewash Israel at a time when Palestinians remain deeply oppressed? Robert Carter, London.
More and more people in the EU are congregating indoors. The highly contagious Delta variant of COVID-19 is spreading like wildfire in countries like France and Spain. More people are also travelling within the EU. Citizens in Brussels have been sharing their thoughts on the Delta variant.
I don't know where the cases come from, if it's a coffee restaurant or just meeting in our house.
When I see how people are behaving sometimes, I'm not surprised.
The European Central Bank, which manages the euro, says economic confidence is being undermined.
The pandemic continues to cast a shadow, especially as the Delta variant constitutes a growing source of uncertainty.
On Monday, EU finance ministers rubber-stamped COVID-19 recovery funding for four additional nations in the 27-country bloc.
Croatia, Cyprus, Lithuania and Slovenia. Now more than a half of national plans is adopted.
However, critics say the billions of euro being administered to national governments will result in citizens being saddled with decades more austerity because there is too much emphasis on loans rather than grants. According to analysts, EU leaders are harming the bloc's economy through their foreign policy. Sanctions are inhibiting trade. Economists say the Iranian market represents a big opportunity. It can be availed of if current efforts to save the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal succeed. We have been speaking to the head of the European Parliament's Iran delegation about the subject via Skype. She believes the agreement will be reinstated soon.
Many people in Iran say, again and again and again, we have not a good partner on this side. This is one of the impacts of this horrible, stupid policy of Trump.
The International Labour Organization, ILO, warns an additional 25 million jobs could be lost globally before the end of this year due to the coronavirus.
However, the ILO says if we see an internationally coordinated policy response, the number of people losing their jobs could be much lower. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Lebanese Prime Minister-designate Najib Mikati said he hoped he can regain the trust of the people in the role of the state. He also vowed to meet with President Michel Aoun regularly in order to speed up the formation of the new government.
There is full unanimity on demand and swiftness in the formation of the new government. And after today's session, I brief President Aoun on the outcome, and I always visit the presidential palace in order to achieve the government's formation as soon as possible.
Mikati spoke after a day of non-binding meetings with Lebanese lawmakers who stated their views after separate consultations. Free Patriotic Movement declared it will not be taking part in the next government, but will offer all the necessary facilitations and support for a quick formation.
We're starting from scratch. We're starting something new, no baggage. No one is carrying any historical disagreements between the parties. That's what we heard from the designated prime minister, and we hope that that will be reflected in the coming future, within hours or days at least, that this will make a difference.
Prime Minister Designate stressed that he has the foreign support necessary to begin economic reforms. One member of parliament told Press TV that when they asked about this support, Mikati stressed that France has given him assurances that after the formation of the cabinet, they will give all assistance to resolve the financial and economic crisis. However, this assistance will not be without interest.
No foreign country would give assistance for free. It has its own interest in mind as well. It's only natural when France gives aid to Lebanon, it has ambitions. If France assists in rebuilding the port, it could be the main future authority in the port of Beirut and could be managing the trade and commerce from Europe to the entire Arab world. If it rebuilds the electricity sector, it will also be a good investment for French companies. And at the same time, Lebanon is in drastic need of that assistance.
The main concern for all sides is salvaging the country's economy, which has been described by the World Bank as one of the world's worst since the 1850s. After initial meetings with lawmakers, the real political bargaining begins for the formation of the government. This in itself could prove to be controversial, with Mikati stressing the need for keeping to the French initiative, opponents stressing the need for adhering to the National Charter of Confessional Representation. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
The British government has decided to expand blanket stop and search powers under a new plan to beat crime. Measures unveiled on Tuesday include changes to police powers to allow searching people without suspicion in areas where they believe violence could break out under the Section 60 Criminal Justice and Public Order Act.
Across all stop and searches powers, black people are 9 times more likely to be stopped than white people. But under the Section 60 Act, that rate is even higher at a whopping 18 times. Moreover, the research data shows that in 99% of Section 60 searches, no weapon is found.
Press TV got a reaction to this story from Charles Critchlow, former president of the National Black Police Association. He said,
"This government has abandoned any pretense of a desire for a fair and just society, particularly insofar as black people are concerned. First of all, the efficacy of such an approach is not proven. Moreover, it's counterproductive in that it alienates the community when the support of the community is critical."
His thoughts were echoed by Suleiman Lee, a community activist from Black Child Promotions, who himself has been harassed by the police.
There's always going to be conflict at street level. There's disorganized crime, then there's organized crime. And as I said before, black youth cannot facilitate any criminal underworld. They can only participate. A lot of black youth, they're serving time, even though we're 3% of the population, according to the 2011 census, we're disproportionately represented in the prisons at Her Majesty's pleasure.
The government announcement came 2 months after the Criminal Justice Alliance
a network of 160 organisations called for the power to be repealed, arguing that Section 60 had led to thousands of innocent people being unnecessarily stopped and searched every year. If the number of searches